The show is live and local. It's your connection to local music and more. Later on the show this hour, we'll be talking with Brian Chobin, who is a trumpet player and is leader of the Brian Chobin Jazz Quintet, who are playing twice this week in downtown Bloomington. And we'll hear some recordings of some actually live performances of theirs, recorded live performances. For the first portion of the show, however, I'll be talking with Louis Bergonzi, who is professor of conducting and music education at the University of Illinois. And he recently co-hosted a symposium here on campus with the title of Establishing Identity, LGBT Studies in Music and Education, and Music Education. And for those of you who don't know, the LGBT moniker, it's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered. And there were a lot of interesting topics covered in that symposium, and he's been looking at some of the connections between, or what perhaps ought to be connections between sexual orientation and music education. And we'll talk about that on the hour and hear some music as well. It's live and local on FM 90.9. That was music by Aaron Copland. An excerpt from his Appalachian Spring called Simple Gifts, and a performance here by, who was on this performance? Track 8, the Philharmonia Virtuosi, conducted by Richard Kapp, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. Thanks for joining us today, and sorry I wasn't able to make it in yesterday. I've been having some back problems that have been rather prohibitive to moving around too much. But we are here today, and I'm glad we were able to make it because I've been looking forward to this conversation with Louis Bergonzi, who is a music education professor and also teaches conducting at the University of Illinois School of Music. And we thank you for coming in and talking to us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Louis, pull your mic just a little bit more in your general direction, and that'll help. The topic that piqued my interest I knew this was going on, although it was also happening at the same time I was doing something with the youth orchestra in town, and in any event wasn't a participant, but the symposium that was on campus, I guess that was in May.
May 23-26.
Uh-huh. 23-26, Establishing Identity, LGBT Studies, and Music Education. Before we talk about that specifically, because there's quite a lot of topics around there, I sort of wanted to reference the introduction that Vic DiGeronimo gave to me. I always chat with him right at the end of his show about what's going to be on today's show. And since I wasn't here yesterday, I wasn't able to record my usual promo. So he didn't know what was going to be on the show. So he said, well, Kevin has a secret to share. And I thought, well, that's an interesting lead-in because some of this business about sexual orientation and music education has to do with keeping a secret that maybe shouldn't be kept secret, or should it? And that's one of the questions.
Well, it shouldn't if one wants a more comprehensive and accurate understanding of the world. I mean, sexuality hasn't been termed as such for very long, but certainly human sexuality has been in existence for a while. So it should be if you want to provide a comprehensive and accurate picture of reality.
Well, for example, in the initial publication on the website, I think it was, I forget where I pulled some of these things, mm-hmm. There were some sample topics for consideration for this, and one of them was, what do I know and teach about homosexuality? Do I tell my students about Menotti and Barber, for example, or in this case about Aaron Copland, since I started with his music? Mm-hmm. This comes from a disc that is called Out Classics by 8 of the world's greatest composers who just happened to be gay, or may have been, or almost certainly were, et cetera, Aaron Copland certainly was, and he wasn't exactly out, as we call it today, mm-hmm. but he wasn't exactly not. It was one
he
of
sort
these...
of did the Rosie O'Donnell, I'm out to anyone who knows strategy.
Yeah, or something like that.
I'm out to those who know.
Or I saw a reference to the conductor Robert Spano down at Atlanta. I should have written this down. Notoriously closeted or something like that.
Right. Well, he's the first out appointment as a music director in America. So,
Philadelphia Orchestra, I understand, mm-hmm. just appointed somebody mm-hmm. who was very out and with a an established partner and so on. But in any event, so, I mean, how do you answer that question? Do I tell my students about Menotti and Barber? And for those of you who don't know, they were lovers, Giancarlo Menotti and Samuel Barber, for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, teachers tend to think they're operating in a sterile environment when it comes to sexual orientation, that I don't need to teach homosexuality because, after all, I don't teach heterosexuality, when in fact their daily life and their daily ways of instructing students have a lot to do with their, in most cases, heterosexuality. Anytime a teacher says, my husband and I were on a trip when I heard this concert, or my wife and I went to see so-and-so conduct, they're letting their students know about their orientation, and they're reaffirming that there is but one, in this case, heterosexuality. So the idea that we shouldn't teach students about sexual orientation really doesn't hold water when you look at the ways teachers interact with their students, both pedagogically and off the podium, so to speak. So there's a lot of reinforcement of heterosexuality, but which is, that's who the teachers are in most cases. But students who are in the room, whose families may be, they may have same-sex parents, or who themselves are either struggling or accepting, or know a friend who's accepting, it can mean a lot when their teacher acknowledges the very existence of something besides homosexuality. Heterosexuality.
There, you just did it.
Right, right, exactly. It's not natural, it's just more common.
Yeah, there certainly were plenty of well-known composers who, as I said, in reference to this particular recording, who were reputed to have been, or almost certainly were. Copland is one, Benjamin Britten is one, mm-hmm. who certainly was. Chopin is one of those there's a question mark around, I guess. Tchaikovsky is one who, that you actually can. His is maybe one of the stories where it's a little more open that he quite possibly or probably was. Tchaikovsky.
Yes. Well, in fact, the history of Tchaikovsky and his sexual orientation is quite interesting because it tells us a lot about the history of sexual orientation, which first emerged in medical discourse. And he and Oscar Wilde were sort of the poster children for the troubled, suicidal, unhappy pervert of the late 19th century. And so Tchaikovsky, the early biographies, particularly those by Anglo and German musicologists, really painted a picture of Tchaikovsky that sort of clouds the whole issue. So not only is the information of his time suspect, but it hasn't been until recently where people have looked at him in a more comprehensive view and thought about what the discourse about him says about sexual orientation in its history.
Well, the story is that has been told, and not always made absolutely clear, is he had this patroness, Nadezhda mm-hmm. von Meck, did they or didn't they have a relationship? Well, probably not, since they never met face-to-face. But he got married and then got into a horrible depression because he knew he didn't belong to be married, and, he had this big secret that
the story may be told or not.
Well, what was the secret?
He certainly had a secret, and his same-sex attractions was certainly troubling to him. But there's a new book out of, I believe it's University of Michigan Press, by a musicologist there, and he sort of puts forth that Tchaikovsky wasn't as messed up as we think. At some parts of his life, he was fairly accepting of himself and enjoyed life and his sexual orientation. It was those around him who sought to keep his image clear and clean, and he was troubled most particularly about his father's reaction. That was clear, but they had to paint him to be troubled and messed up in order to make a good story about homosexuals and the intersex perverts of the time. So he was around that same time as all that medical discourse, and it's an interesting picture. Still cloudy, but it says a lot about how sexual orientation and the way we look at it is something that is a cultural value. I mean, without heterosexuality, there would be no homosexuality. You need one to have the other. And it wasn't until medical discourse that the whole notion of the homosexual came to be. So it's not that old a concept.
When you say heterosexual, without heterosexuality, meaning because it's that you wouldn't be able to procreate at all?
No, the concept. folks who had I don't mean to be a sexologist here, but folks who had same-sex attractions and engaged in same-sex practices weren't thought to be homosexuals for a great deal of time. They were just thought to be men who had sex with other men, and they and society didn't label them anything in particular. They were just men who had sex with men for various reasons. And it wasn't until medical discourse, again, the late 19th century, that the objectification and the diagnosis of what these folks were came to be. And at that point, an artifact of that was separating same-sex attraction from opposite-sex attraction. So both were constructed at the same time. There couldn't be the concept of homosexuality if there were not the concept of heterosexuality and vice versa.
Franz Schubert was another of those who was mm-hmm. Yes, no, do we know, and does it matter?
Well, there was a whole uproar. Not uproar is maybe too strong a word. Well, no. Well, let's use the word uproar in musicological circles. Again, that question, your last question was, and does it matter? Applying a perspective on Schubert from sexual orientation or his lifestyle, let's call it that, applying that to Schubert's music allows a new way of looking at him. Schubert is often thought to and described as sort of, well, this part is like Beethoven, but he's not quite Beethoven. Reviewers of concerts of the time, so well, it's sort of a feminine music. So gender was certainly part of the discussion around Schubert at the time. And so looking at Schubert through Beethoven, we often talk about Beethoven in very masculine terms. He's the hero, the stoic composer who stands up. And so we masculinize and put Beethoven as this Germanic hero. And that leaves us, well, what do we do about Schubert? And for many years, it was, well, Schubert was just sort of a diluted, feminized Beethoven. But if you apply notions of queer theory and open up another perspective on Schubert, not only in terms of how you think about his life, but how you actually analyze the music. There are musicologists who are analyzing Schubert just as they analyze any other composer. The way you analyze and look at the music opens up a new way to think about it. I have conducted Schubert Unfinished Symphony a few times in my life, and when I started reading the new musicology, which is the term for this kind of inquiry, the new musicology about Schubert, and I went to conduct the music, I suddenly wasn't thinking about how the score in front of me related to music of his time, Beethoven in particular, but I was able to think of Schubert as different and unique and unto himself rather than in relation to the heterosexual hero, Beethoven. So it led me to sort of pay more attention to modulations, to transitions, much more of the other parts of the piece of the score that wasn't Beethoven-like. And because I could look at Schubert as a sort of party animal homosexual, which apparently he was, if I looked at him that way as a person and composer unto himself as opposed to in relation to Beethoven, it led me to a different interpretation of the score. It led me to the smaller points, to the ambiguities. The ambiguities became really important instead of the parts that sort of sounded like a feminized Beethoven.
And are you thinking of one movement more than
the
other?
Movement,
the second
in particular.
Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the
unfinished. Those amazing transitions.
And the unfinished, of course, wasn't finished. So mm-hmm. There's only these two movements. Well, let's give a listen, and we won't really be able to comment as we go.
Right, right.
But just with that in mind, maybe people can listen to a part of it here.
And if you compare various recordings, there are some that are incredibly diligent about portraying this piece as heroic. And emphasizing the heroic qualities. And there are others that sort of take time in different spots.
Well, you can tell us which one you think
okay.
this one is.
I'll do my best.
As we go along. This is the second movement of Schubert's Eighth Symphony, known as The Unfinished. And this is a performance by the, I won't say.
So here we have these heroic chords. The brass are playing and the strings have this unison string section, moving line. And then it sort of makes a transition, not so surprising. So we get these heroic passages and we have some Sturm und Drang coming up. And then we get to these transitions where he switches keys enharmonically from, let's say, on a G sharp becomes an A flat or vice versa. And so the whole notion of enharmonic transposition is somewhat queer, if you will. It allows for both to operate at the same time, which is part of the notion of queer theory. Simultaneous multiple perspectives. Here it is.
That section sounded to me like what could have been the masculine Beethoven
mm-hmm, exactly.
at work there and then lapsing off into something
mm-hmm.
else right here.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, that's some of the Unfinished Symphony of Schubert, the second movement. The Vienna Philharmonic was led by Carlos Kleiber in that performance. So would you say that one was... how would you characterize that little bit of what we heard in the performance there? Somebody who was aware or not?
Well, certainly emphasized the lyric and the interesting harmonic moves. It's not something necessarily one can hear. It just allows the possibility when one is looking at a text, a score, to allows for another possibility. And that's really important in the arts, is to allow for different possibilities. And by opening up the notions of what is possible, it allows for more interesting and personal interpretations.
And it almost doesn't make any difference whether Schubert had any of this
exactly.
at all in mind.
And it doesn't matter whether he was gay or not, whether he had same-sex attractions or had a long-term partner or whatever. It just matters that we view him with the possibility, or view anyone with the possibility of, well, there's not black and white. There's a whole continuum of possibilities.
So it's just a way of interpreting.
Yeah, it's reading it as a cultural text.
Now, what about in teaching music? One of the I actually did a search online, and the first thing that popped up, one of the early things that popped up on Google with your name attached, was this article on onenewsnow.com.
Oh dear!
a division of the American Family News Network, and somebody was taking a great exception to your article called "Sexual Orientation in Music Education,"
yeah.
continuing. a tradition. And I read somewhere else who said, well, this person actually gave a reasonable summary of that article. But why don't you try to summarize that article for you a little, for us a little bit, and you know, what might be the objections, or you know, what was the point you were trying to make?
Sure. Well, the point I was trying to make was that in music education, particularly music education as it occurs in schools, there's a position of privilege awarded to heterosexuality. Privilege in terms of the content we teach. We're very comfortable teaching things about Wagner and how his love affairs inspired a lot of his great music, love affairs that weren't always associated with his wife at the time, but that doesn't seem to bother anybody. But we're more comfortable doing that than we are mentioning Benjamin Britten and Peter Peirce. Their relationship had a profound influence on the development of 20th century opera. And to ignore that when teaching music history demonstrates a bias and a willingness to focus only on the heterosexual. So it biases our curriculum and our content in music education in a number of ways. And then it also, there's a privilege given to heterosexuality with regard to the teachers and the students who are in our classes. There are certain privileges that students who are heterosexuality enjoy. For instance, the spring musical is always going to have a love story. Unless they're doing Rent, that resembles the kind of love that that a heterosexual student is going to identify with. Students are often asked, do you have a boyfriend if they're female, when they could have a girlfriend? Teachers, on the other hand, teachers also have certain privileges if they're heterosexual. As I mentioned earlier, they can talk about examples from their personal life without having to conceal information or use ambiguous kinds of pronouns. If a gay teacher talks about going to see the Marine Band with, let's say, her partner, a straight teacher won't be accused of talking about sex, whereas a homosexual teacher might be accused of promoting the homosexual lifestyle if she talked about her partner. In many states, you can be fired for no other reason than you're being of the minority sexual orientation. I can put pictures of my family with my spouse on my desk if I'm straight without having to worry that someone's going to see it, or my partner may leave a phone message on my machine in the office and don't have to worry about that if I'm heterosexual. So there are privileges both in terms of the content of what we teach and who we teach that have to do with heterosexuality. So I was trying to just raise those questions and ask whether it's time we consider these privileges. And the responses were small, large, supportive, angry, of a lot of people praying for me in different parts of the country, and they're hoping that I will repent. So the reactions were all over the map, but my point was to get people, and the article is very much a question. Thought-provoking article. It really doesn't ask to take anyone to take any position, but it does ask them, the readers, to at least think about the question. So I was very happy to have those kinds of responses come my way. There were some who didn't see the notion of heterosexual privilege. They didn't think that teachers privileged sexual orientation of any type, and it had no place in the classroom. And I think just being a fly on the wall in the room would take care of that. We oftentimes talk about or make references to our sexual orientation or our love life or personal life. So that's fine. Some folks thought that notion of privilege was in fact there. They had no argument that heterosexuality is privilege, but they thought that was a good thing because that's the correct sexual orientation. So that was easier to swallow than the folks who thought that there was no privilege at all. So the article, believe it or not, December 2009 was the first time the word sexual orientation appeared in a music educator's journal ever, despite musicologists 1989 was the founding of the American Musicological Society's gay and lesbian groups. That's, 20 years musicologists have been looking at this. Educators have been looking at sexual orientation in schools for about 15 years, looking at issues of personal safety, acceptance of same-sex families, helping teachers shift their thinking a bit. So education and musicology have both been willing to look at these issues, and my field of music education hasn't been until recently.
Which seems to be more than ironic, given that just the field of music in general, as is true for all of the arts, seems to have at least a higher percentage of openly gay people working in those fields for some reason
or another. There's this notion that the arts are an accepting place and a safe space for students. There's a wonderful book called When the Drama Club Isn't Enough about helping high school students who are gay in their school. But I think once you put the arts in an educational context and it gets in the torrent of values and expectations and positions, then the doors start to close. So the arts outside of schools may, in fact, be, and I do think they are, more of an accommodating place than the rest of society. Once you put that in an educational institution, the educational values swamp any acceptance of sexual orientation.
Well, there was one of the articles that was presented at the symposium you co-hosted earlier this year. Mm-hmm. It was entitled Discourses Surrounding Marginalized Groups, LGBT Issues, and Music Learning and Teaching Practices in Glee, as in the television show.
Exactly.
Which I have only, I think I saw part of one time. I stumbled across it. I've been hearing people talk about it, and I can't even tell you when it's on or what channel it's on. But in general, that seems to be, it seemed to be a lot of marginalized kids who were in theater and musical theater in particular.
Yeah, the whole notion of the Glee Club, which in fact is a show choir, in that TV show is one of island of misfit toys. It's the forgotten kids. It's the odd kids. And only one of them is gay, but being gay isn't the only way a kid can be put on the margins of high school life. There have been some studies about kids' lives in schools and how sexual orientation as a concept influences their school experience.
But if you are, if you're one of being a number of the other marginalized misfits isn't necessarily something that people would feel the need to hide, you know, whether it's because you're confined to a wheelchair or because you, have any of a number of other things that kids make fun of you for. Mm-hmm. But if you're gay, particularly in an area of responsibility at school, say, being a teacher, then that isn't something you're supposed to talk about.
Well, yeah, and if you're gay, you can pass. I mean, if you're in a wheelchair, it's visible. If you're if you're African American and your skin tone gives you away, that's hard to pass as white, although that's a whole other area of history. But you know, the experience of gay students and gay teachers in schools is different from others, and it turns up in things like, you know, 9 out of 10 high school students were verbally harassed because of their orientation. This is according to a 2007 study. 60% of LGBT students feel unsafe because of personal characteristics. 2/3 of LGBT students heard homophobic remarks from school personnel. That doesn't reflect well on an institution that's so important as schools are.
Do you have a sense why it's been left out of the music education discussion for so long?
Boy, that's a really great question, and I think that's one of the research areas that I would love my profession to start to deal with. One of the studies presented at the symposium had to do with the lives of music teachers and how from high school through undergraduate through looking for a job through their first years on the job, a LGBT teacher has to constantly wrestle with the notion of the closet. If they're out in high school, maybe they'll continue in college, but when they start looking for a job, do they put themselves back in the closet? Do they tweak their resume to clean it up of any references to a gay-straight alliance or working at the LGBT office at the university? Do they straighten up their resume, so to speak? And then the whole issue of, well, I'm out, I'm proud, and I'm certified, and I have a job. And then I go to my position, and I'm forced to go back into the closet. And this is a theme that came up in a number of studies, how the LGBT teacher has to constantly wrestle with that closet. It's not just something you open up and you're done. It happens every day and every time you move into a new setting. So that was, I think, one of the major themes throughout the symposium. It turned up in different ways. One researcher, a straight researcher, was interviewing a small group of teachers privately, and she was up to her last interview, the fourth out of four, and she went to the school, and on that day, classes were canceled, and it was a teacher conference day. And she met with her subject and sat down to the interview, and through eye contact and nonverbal communication, the gay teacher let her know that he was nervous that the other teachers were just sort of knocking on the door and saying hi, and it wasn't a private setting for their interview, as had been the case when she interviewed him on the earlier days. And so she saw the terror in her eyes, and she stopped. She said, I had just stopped my study of him, and the study became of me. Because it was when I saw the fear in his eyes when someone walked up to us and was wondering what we were talking about and how he had to carefully code his language with me, she said, who I've conducted multiple interviews with this person. There was certainly a zone of safety around him, but in the setting of his school when a teacher could walk by or see them talking, she said the study became of my reaction to his closet and a deeper understanding on my part of what his life was like every day.
Hmm. You told me before we walked into the studio today that you had a story of a female student. Has something to do with Tchaikovsky?
Well, nothing to do with this case. Nothing to do with female. It was a middle school student. And that's pertinent to the story in that it was a middle school student here at Illinois Summer Youth Music. Within the past 5 years, and we were doing Tchaikovsky March Slav, a middle school arrangement, and I played the opening for the orchestra, and
a recording.
No, on my instrument.
Oh, okay.
I played it for
the violin.
Them. Yep, just played the theme, and we all learned it, and we all learned how to shape it and phrase it. And then I said, "So, what do you think?" I said to the orchestra, "I said, what do you think?" Tchaikovsky was trying to get across here. What do you think he was trying to make you feel, or how do you feel? You know, and this young lady in the front raised her hand, and I called on her, and she looked up at me, and she said, "Well, I think melancholy." Well, here, melancholy. She's 12 years old. She hears 8 bars of a Tchaikovsky theme, and she comes up with melancholy. Well, the teacher in me went, "Well, what do I do with that?" Do I say, "Well, okay, let's discuss why. Well, the augmented third, blah, blah, blah." Or do I say, "Well, that's okay. What do I do with that information?" It was certainly an opening into discussing Tchaikovsky and his melancholy, his clinical depression, if you want to do retrospective analysis. It was one of those moments I was confronted with it. And in the real-time decision, was to talk to the orchestra about the fact that Tchaikovsky, for a lot of his life, felt that if people really knew him, they wouldn't like him. That if people knew really who he was and what he was thinking and feeling, they wouldn't like him. And that certainly is a middle school, early adolescent kind of moment. It's classic, everyone's looking at me, what do they think of me? Peer pressure, peer identity. So I was able. I tapped into the notion of identity and how we fit into society, in the hopes that it would matter to these middle school students, but also as a way to tie into Tchaikovsky without getting into his sexual orientation, because my decision at that time was that middle school was not. It was not necessary. Middle school was more important that I tap into the notion of feeling alienated. Without getting into the cause. So those moments happen, and we do our best. And with high school kids, I talk about his sexual orientation right out there, and I think that's important.
So if you were conducting a high school group at the time, you might have said, well, this is what the melancholy
from. I'd read letters, and they would read, yes, exactly.
Here's a little bit of the March Slav of Tchaikovsky. That opening melancholy theme with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra led by Yuri Temirkanov. The opening melancholy portion of the Tchaikovsky March Slav, or Slavic March, the Royal Philharmonic led by Yuri Tamerkhanov. And, you know, I remember playing that as a kid on the piano, back when I played any piano. And indeed, that part is melancholy, but then it, the tune changes about halfway through.
And I took it slower.
Altogether.
slower tempo.
Well, I took it a whole lot slower on the piano, I'll tell you, back then. Well, Louis, this is a topic that we could, you know, not even begun to scratch the surface, but I was going to ask you, and I guess maybe you answered part of the question, which is, what do you think should be done? You know, how should sexuality be interjected into music education, or homosexuality, in the same ways
that heterosexuality is. One letter to the editor in response to my article was, "Well, I need more practical ideas about how to teach music history when it comes to the lives of gay composers." And my response is, "You teach it the same way. I mean, you use it when it's appropriate. Use it when it fits the musical moments in your lesson plan." But the issue is that she even needs to ask, this is a woman, that she even needed to ask the question. It's done the same way, but the fact that we have to ask the question says a lot about our society.
Well, just going back to an example that you gave, I guess people can analyze, how would they treat a certain subject with let's say, Richard Wagner, because you said he had affairs with women who weren't necessarily his wife, and the study, you know, the books freely say that, you know, he made out with the wife of Liszt or the wife of the conductor, Hans von Bülow, for example, like that. That's it said. But yet, if you're going to talk about that in the classroom, well, then you ought to talk about the equivalent.
Well, and you talk
somebody
right, and you
life.
Talk about it in the classroom at the moment it's pertinent. You know, the counterpart to that is, so he was inspired by this love he felt strongly, and high school students are in the throes of their first love, so they can relate to that notion. And so here you need to use a richer vibrato and faster bow speed. I mean, you have to sort of tie it into the whole lesson. But to a high school kid to say, you know, this isn't passionate enough. Wagner was doing this at the time of, that really inspires them because they're in the throes of their first love and they can identify to that.
So then you ought to be able to say that Tchaikovsky was inspired in the throes of
depression?
Non-love, you know, because this was his state, which is not so different from the state
or Lincoln
of
portrait being pulled from the Eisenhower inauguration because of Copeland being part of the McCarthy hearings and a communist, and the Lavender Scare of being gay. I mean, that was pulled. It was pulled, I think, 2 weeks before the inauguration of Eisenhower.
For example, I didn't know that. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. So, I mean, musicology, this is almost mainstream now. I mean, Grove's Dictionary of Music has a very lengthy article on lesbian and gay music, and it's not just composers who happen to be gay. It's about how their being gay in the society of their time affected their music.
So it's not, it is, you're not suggesting in any way that any of this be interjected either randomly or gratuitously.
Exactly.
Just as you would with heterosexual composers, performers, if it seems, you know, if it fits the topic at the time, bring it up. It has to do with the music making and why these people are who they are. Well, as I said, we just scratched the surface, and there's so many interesting topics that were at this symposium you co-hosted we could talk about another time. But that's what we have time for today. My guest on this portion of Live and Local, Louis Bergonzi, who teaches music education and conducting at the University of Illinois School of Music, and recently co-hosted the symposium Establishing Identity, LGBT Studies, and Music Education. Coming up in just a moment, jazz trumpet player Brian Chobin, whose quintet will be playing a couple of times in Bloomington this week. Thank you. My guest on this portion of Live and Local is Brian Chobin, who leads the Brian Chobin Jazz Quintet. They're performing a couple of times this week. Tomorrow, during the lunch hour from 11:30 to 1, the Downtown Bloomington Lunchtime Concert. And then on Saturday, the Downtown Bloomington Farmers Market, starting at 9 in the morning until noon, and then a number of performances after that. Thanks very much for joining me on the show.
No problem.
You are, I have caught you at work, so you're a State Farm employee.
Yes, I am.
I gather. And what do you do for State Farm?
I am an intranet consultant, and intranet means internal. It's our internal web pages here at State Farm that we do governance for.
And in the quintet, you are the trumpet player.
Yes, I am.
Yes, and how long
trumpet
have you...
Trumpet player and leader.
And leader, right. Well, yeah. We assumed that from the name. how long has the quintet been around?
The quintet's been around for about 5 years. We were formed in 1995. Most of the guys that are in the band right now are original. Bruce Lane, who plays also, he plays our piano, and he plays bass trumpet. He's an original member of the group. And so is Jeff Greenberg, who is our drummer. And it's kind of interesting, when we first started the group, it was Jeff that really kind of prompted me to get this group going. Him and I, we sat across from each other here at work, and Jeff was talking about music. He's a record producer. He has his own recording studio in his basement. He's produced a number of albums himself. He has a website called 100 Year Picnic, if you wanted to go check him out there. And I've played on a couple of his albums. But anyway, he said, hey, you know, I'm really into jazz, too. I'd like to, you know, kind of start playing out. And so he convinced me to start getting some gigs. So we got some guys together, and the Brian Chobin Jazz Quintet was born.
And you've been playing jazz then how long yourself?
Forever? I've been playing my trumpet since fourth grade, so that's been about 40 years now. I started, you know, playing jazz in, you know, junior high. We had what we called the stage band, and then in high school, and then in college, I went to Joliet Junior College, played in the jazz bands there, and then Illinois State. I've just continued through my adult life.
Have you had your own group before the quintet?
No, I have not.
And have you been a sideman in other people's groups?
Oh, yes. I've been a sideman. I would call a freelance trumpet player. I've played in a number of different groups. Of course, I told you about, you know, I've been the Illinois State Jazz Band. Mm-hmm. And then there was a group here in Bloomington called the Alternatives. I don't know if anybody remembers them. They used to play down at Central Station, above Central Station. Every Thursday night we used to play back in the early, late 70s, early 80s. And then I've played in a number of dance bands, including the Guy Lombardo Orchestra, Tony Barron Orchestra, which is out of Champaign there, Johnny Kay, Ron Scott, Aristocrats, Jim Markham Swing Band. And then I've also played in a number of local bands here, like the Prairie Land Dixie Band. And also State Farm has their own State Farm employee big band that I play in.
No kidding. Well, I think I mentioned when we talked last week, in setting up this interview, that we had a conversation with an a cappella group that is based at State Farm there as well, the name of which I'm forgetting. It's a room number at, I guess, where they used to rehearse there at the offices.
Yes, I believe it's J103, I believe. And that's the room number. That's what they call themselves because it's the room number that they're rehearsing.
So are there a bunch of these groups, or is it just the a cappella group and the big band?
Just the a cappella group and the big band.
Out of an employee group of about how many at State Farm? Hundreds and
hundreds? Oh, there's a good 15,000 here at State Farm now.
Really?
And growing, yes.
No kidding. That's a small town.
Yeah. And so and the group is open to everyone here, that employees, their families, and even retirees.
You're talking about the big band now?
Yeah, correct.
How often does that group rehearse?
That group rehearses twice a month. Every other week.
And the usual full complement of horns and rhythm section.
Yeah, it's a 21-piece big band. You know, five saxes, five bones, five trumpets, and then a rhythm section.
Wow, that's a lot of fun. Is it pretty good?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a lot of fun. Gives a lot of the employees, you know, that haven't played for a while, a chance to pick up their horns, get them, you know, knock the rust off of them and get out and play.
Are you the leader of that group or somebody else?
No, I'm not. Somebody else. Currently, it's John Larson.
Does that leadership sort of pass around?
Yes, it does.
You have a wonderful feature on your website in that if people are interested in checking out your group, they're under the music tab at briancchoban.com, and that's BRIANCHOBAN. You can actually find all complete clips of all kinds of performances from different venues, and I pulled a number off of there. Do you record everything that you play?
Yes, we try to record everything we play. Usually set up I've got a little MP3 recorder, a little iRiver it's called, and I have a little Sony mic, and I just put that out in front of the band and just let it roll.
And that is for posterity or for diagnostic purposes or what?
A little bit of both. We like to put it on the website so people can hear what we sound like. And then the other thing is, the guys in the band love to go back and hear, the different solos we did. We can talk about how we, did an intro to a tune and then change it up, make some changes to it. So a little bit of educational purpose there, too.
Most of what I saw on there appears to be other people's tunes, but then again, some of the tunes I don't recognize the names. Do you do mostly covers, as it were, or standards, or do you do some of your own compositions?
Mostly covers. When we started out, we did head tunes, we call it. We did them out of the real book. But then, as we developed, our bass player Tom Fotten came into the group, he's a composer, and so he started bringing in a few tunes. One of them is that Samba D Loves You. It was a little play on words there, and he had it was a tune he had heard as he was working out, and he had heard it over the radio, and he took that and he transcribed it and wrote it out for trumpet and bass trumpet as a duet.
This is we're going to play that in just a moment. I'm curious about the bass trumpet, though. I think that it's been about a week since I had this conversation with the fellow who does Aduki Jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've got a bass trumpet player in there. Would
that
happen to be the same guy?
Same guy, yes, it is. It's the same guy.
Well, we'll be talking to him or airing that interview on the tomorrow's show.
Yeah. So everyone in my band plays in other bands also. So there's not really exclusive to just this group, but everyone plays in other bands.
Well, that's certainly what happens over here in Champaign-Urbana from where we're broadcasting, and I imagine that throughout the jazz world, people play the same instruments in different bands, and sometimes they even lead different bands, but if the composition is slightly different, maybe even just by one person, the group has a different name.
Correct.
Which
yeah.
I've always found kind of amusing. Well, let's listen to this song. It's Samba D Loves You. That's spelled Samba D apostrophe Loves You. This is the Brian Chobin Jazz Quintet from about a year ago, July of 2009, at the Normal Amphitheater, and you're hearing them here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Thank you. Brian Chobin Jazz Quintet playing the tune Samba de Loves You from the Normal Amphitheater last July. This week, they're going to be playing at the Downtown Bloomington Lunchtime Concert tomorrow from 11:30 to 1, and on Saturday at the Downtown Bloomington Farmers Market from 9 to noon. And we're pleased to have Brian on the show today. There's more to that interview, which I will put up on our website at will.illinois.edu. And you can send us information about your events or your organization at willcalendar@illinois.edu, willcalendar@illinois.edu. The Chris Raymond Jazz Combo is playing at the Iron Post in downtown Urbana tonight at 7 o'clock. The Decatur Municipal Band plays at Central Park in Decatur tonight at 7. The Marvin Lee Band is at Kickapoo Landing in Oakwood tomorrow evening at 5:30. David Howie is at Houlihan's in downtown Champaign tomorrow evening at 6. And Kevin Hart and the Vibe Tribe are at the Trailside Market in Normal tomorrow from 3:30 until 6. Support for our show today comes in part from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. And we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. It'll be mostly cloudy this afternoon with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high 85, currently 80 degrees. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WYNL-FM and HD1 and HD2.